Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Just Wanna Quilt, a research podcast coming out of Tulane University Law School, where we explore all kinds of things, stories about quilting, tools, field trips, maybe some famous quilters stop by, and, of course, a little bit of copyright thrown in just for fun. I'm Elizabeth Townsend-Gard. I'm a law professor, and I just want to quilt. All right, so today we're talking with Cheryl Sloboda. If you haven't heard her first podcast, she was part of our initial release at the beginning of last month, so it seemed appropriate to have her again for our anniversary. This is a really cool interview about her vision of what the quilting industry looks like, and I hope you enjoy it. Part two, we're talking with Cheryl Sloboda. And this is a different day. So I had a lot of things I wanted to ask her, and she was willing to come back for a second session. So I really do appreciate it. I'm super psyched to chat with you. So the first thing I want to say. The first thing I want to say is that your 31-day blog. I'm a blog failure. So I feel like I have not. I've been trying, and then I didn't. But I think I'm going to go back. So the big question is for me. Is it cheating if you do the post you wanted to do but just backdate them? Is that a reasonable thing to do, or is that just not in the spirit of the whole blogging thing? I've been doing tons of work for this project, but the blogging, I think one of the questions I have with you with blogging is I always feel like I'm doing all this stuff behind the scenes, but I'm not ready to sort of talk about it. Do you find yourself having that problem where you're not ready to do it, but sort of, I'd love you to understand your strategy of how to blog each day.
Well, I think a lot of us, we end up thinking that, it's going to be so easy to blog every single day. And then when you actually have to sit down and write something every single day, it's a lot harder than it sounds. And then we also feel this, like, strange amount of guilt for not doing it either. So it's sort of a double-edged sword. It's like, oh, I said I would blog every day and I promised people and now they're out there waiting for me and I'm not saying anything. But we're also very used to now, and I think that the reason blogs sort of fall away in the things that we do is because we're so wrapped up in social media. And what I do is I just use the same content that I would put on social media. So if I'm going to share a picture of what I'm sewing today or whatever, I'm going to put that on my blog and share it there as well. And so it doesn't have to be hard. The other thing is, and it's as you say, as an artist or as someone who's working on many projects that can't be revealed yet, it's hard to put content out there if you have to keep everything a secret. And so I think we run into that. Well, the only thing I'm sewing is this thing that I can't show anybody yet. And therefore, it looks like you have nothing to say. And that's where it is good to start talking about yourself or, things going on with you. Because you then become more real to the reader. Versus this robot that just pushes out more, more quilts, more designs, more this, more that. You're actually a person. Like, I had to take the day off because, I didn't feel so well or whatever. It just makes you feel like more like a real person. So feel bad.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. We're doing all these experiments. We keep asking people to send us samples of their patterns so that I can experience it and all that, so that we can. And I don't think I would have experienced the stress of blogging every day if I hadn't tried to do the challenge. So it's been really interesting to sort of you learn as you you experience all of this stuff. So so that's good, I guess. But one of the other things I started to think about is I'm doing all these ridiculous projects, and maybe I should be doing the blogging as I'm doing the project and just storing it for later, so that there's got to be a better rhythm to all of this. So I feel like by the time I'm ready to share something, I'm not going to care. But then when I am doing it, I should, I don't know. You got to figure it all out. And I'm probably can share along the way, too. I think it's just because the podcast isn't up yet. So it feels weird to be talking about interviews that people
What I do is I take all the photos, like all my in-process photos for all of that content that's going to come later. Mm-hmm. Because once I reveal the project, then I want people to know how I made it and all the struggles that I had during that process. So I think that that's where those things come in. Those, you can still take all the photos and make your notes like you were, so that you can blog about it later, because again, these secret projects, you know, I think, any quilter who's ever tried to enter a contest or, you know, wanted to submit something to the magazine, you can't put that out in the world yet. You have to sort of keep it a secret. And that's where things look like, it looks like you're not doing anything.
It's true. It's really true.
It's the exact opposite. You're busier than ever.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what happened, which is really an interesting experience, because I was like, all I'm doing is this project. It's completely taken over my life, and I have nothing to blog about. So anyway, I'm working it out. It's been an interesting personal moment thinking through who am I exactly, which is very silly. All right, so on to more. So that's the blog thing. So I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep doing and try to get it. Keep going on it. So hold on just a sec.
Yeah.
Okay. So the industry. When you look at the industry, sort of, do you have like, I'm starting to look at things and seeing different buckets of experiences and people and what it looks like. And I'm curious if you could help me a little bit map out what you see, how you would sort of like kind of mind map the industry. What does it look like? What does the quilting industry look like at this stage, do you think? Is that hard? Is that too hard a question?
Oh boy.
Yeah.
You know, I think the quilt industry is going through a period of change, and I don't know that everybody's even like aware that it's changing, or they're just now being aware that it's been changing for a few years, and the reality of the new industry is catching up with us. You know, I think that the internet has changed a lot of the game for the industry, and it didn't really catch up until now. And I say that because, you know, the demographic for quilters, as you know, from the annual survey that was released, the average age dropped a whole year, from 64 to 63. And you're talking about, so that's the average, which means there's quilters who are much older, and then there's quilters who also are younger. And you're talking about a demographic that doesn't really, like, truly use the internet other than a research tool. And I think that when you look at the internet that we're using now, like, I use the internet to physically run my business. And now, you know, people have moved from catalogs to online ordering. They've moved from, you know, getting their information from a visit from a sales rep to an email announcement from the company and place your order on our website today. And I think that when you look at the industry, there's three different arms in my opinion. So if I had to mind map it, right, there's three, immediately there's three things. There's the manufacturers who make the fabric and the tools and the things that we need to use to make our quilts. Then you have the stores, which are largely independent, and there's very few chains in the or big box that we would think of in every other industry, like bookstore. There's no chain quilt store. There's chain fabric stores, but there's no chain quilt store. And so for the most part, we're buying our products from a mom and pop independent retailer. And then you have the third arm, which is the teachers, the designers, the people who are professionals in the industry, but are not a manufacturer and they're not a store. And so that's the three arms of the industry that I see. I'm sure there's more. Manufacturers, of course, can get broken out into machines and fabric and other tools and thread. And, you know, so there's a bunch of different types of manufacturing. And then, you know, even the stores, there are only machine stores. There are only fabric stores. There's the hybrid of the two. There's stores that focus on teaching and there's stores that have no teaching. And, you know, the same thing for the individual professional arm. And that arm has, you know, pattern designers and fabric designers and people like me who teach and also have patterns and everything else. So it's sort of an omni, you know, channel type thing. So that's where I see the industry. And I see the industry as trying to grow in two of the channels. I think the pattern designers and independents have always been very internet savvy. And I see that the manufacturers have definitely become more internet savvy. And the stores are the ones who are catching up. And that's not a negative against them. They actually have more on their plate than any of the rest. You know, they are trying to keep the lights on and keep the customers happy and have the right product mix and anticipate everybody's needs in the future. And they're ordering their product months in advance before they even know if it will sell. And I'm very familiar with that type of retailing because of my years in the comic book industry, which is a very similar type of customer. So it's the manufacturers who I think have made the most change to the industry that we're all still catching up with. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how relevant is quilt market anymore, which is the big industry trade show event, because when you go to quilt market now, most of the fabric lines are already out. And I think that the, you know, the store owner has less reason to go to quilt market than they did in the past. And so I think that's why we see the numbers of attendance declining at quilt market. And that's not because the market is shrinking that much. It's because they're getting their information from someplace else. They don't have to get it at quilt market. That's my opinion.
That's really interesting.
Well, I'm not the only one who holds this opinion, but yeah. I might be the only one willing to put a voice to it. Yeah. Now, I will say that I always go to quilt market and I love quilt market. I find that I make it worth it for me to go, both as an independent and as someone who has, you know, product lines and things like that. But there are people who are, you know, what we need is to entice the independent designers back and the store owners back. And I think quilt market can do that with offering lots of education.
Yeah.
So that's, you know.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think
you have to make it worth the store owner's while.
Yeah. A couple of questions come out of that. I see that. I think that's a really great place to start with sort of understanding the industry. That makes a lot of sense. What I was kind of amazed at, well, first I'm amazed that there is no national quilting chain. Do you have any idea why that might be? It seems like there would have been, Crafty seems like it's trying to come in to do that online, to be sort of this massive thing. But why do you think this industry hasn't developed a national big box kind of thing, store?
I think it's the same reason that this didn't happen in comic books. So every area has its own flavor, right? The quilt stores around you are not at all going to be like the quilt stores around me in Chicago. And, you know, the store is usually the taste of the owner, right? So if the owner is really into Civil War reproduction fabrics, then when you go in the store, that's what they're going to see. And some store owners, they're in that niche of a niche, right? So perhaps their fabric mix is very modern, and that's a subset of quilting. And then you have the Civil War reproductions and the country prairie styles. That's also a very narrow subset. And then you have people like quilt stores that try to carry everything. But as you know, you can't carry everything because certain lines don't sell and it's not profitable, or at least stores find out really quickly that they can't carry every single line. And so they have to basically focus on the bestseller. And this is the same thing that happens in comic books, right? So, and I hate to keep using that as an analogy, but it is to me the closest analogy, right? You have nowhere to go. You used to be able to go and buy your comic books off the newsstand, and you can't do that really anymore. You have to go to a comic book store, or you have to order them online. And the thing is people like to open it up and flip through it and see the art. And so they have to go to the store. And this, I think that's still true of fabric stores. Like, they want to go to the store. They want to feel the fabric. They want to hold open the repeat and see the repeat of the fabric. And they want to say, yes, this is the color I would like to have. And sometimes they're not going to get that from their computer screen. So much like a comic book store, it's flavored by the taste of the owner. If he's into superheroes, that's what you're going to see on the shelf. If he's into those independent sort of artsy comics, that's what you're going to see on the shelf. And there isn't a store that can carry everything because, one, there's so much of it out there, and two, some of it doesn't sell. And so when you look at retail, you know, they have that huge...
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Huge challenge of being able to make everybody happy in the market that they're in. And I think that this is something that Joann is trying to do. If you've been in a Joann's recently, they have announced that they've now carrying thousands of quilting cottons, which they've never carried this much before, except for back in the calico days. And when you go in, you know, there is a difference in the base cotton product in a big box store versus the quilting cotton that you buy at your local quilt store. And that's called that gray good, right? And it's not spelled like the color gray. And that base fabric that they print that pattern on, right? It can be the same pattern, but that base fabric that's going to Joann's is going to be not the same quality that you buy at your quilt store. Your quilt store's cotton is going to be of a higher quality, and that is why it is more expensive than what you can buy at a big box store. And I also think that, that eventually Joann's is going to find out, well, they'll find out how big the market really is, because when they're left over with all these remnant bolts, then that project will be over.
So the sales of it is gonna
bear it out.
Yeah. Why do you think Joann's is going to a lesser quality of fabric? I mean, that seems to me.
They always have.
They always have.
They always have. Yeah, they always have. And that may be one of the changes that they're making with this new project. Although, and I have not gone in to test that fabric to determine if it is any different. I have recently bought cotton fabric from Joann's, and it is no different in my mind.
It is not
than what
it
used
is.
To be. Which it is not the same quality as your quilt store's cotton. It's a lower quality. And the thing is they have to make a bigger margin on it. And they're also not charging $10 a yard for it.
Right, and there are all the coupons and all that other stuff too. They're always
exactly,
you know.
Right. So they have to pay a base price that's way cheaper for them, because they just, by the nature of the way they do business, they're going to discount it, and therefore they need to make what profit they can in after that discount's applied.
Yeah.
So this is one, the danger of discounting and coupons, and two, the struggle that an independent retailer has. The independent retailer is looking at where their competition is, and it's other independent retailers, and the discounting that comes from big box and online.
Right.
And there are ways for them to get around that. And what they, but that's the challenge, right? And so, and here's the other area that an independent retailer is very similar to comic book industry. You're talking about someone who opens a business because they have an affinity or they love the industry in some way. They're not opening quilt stores because there's like gobs of money in it and, oh, we're going to be rolling in dough, because then everyone would open one, right? They open it because they love the industry. They perhaps are a quilter. They love the camaraderie of their local quilt store. They love that. And that's what they want to create for their community. And then it's, oh, right, we're here to make profit. I'm not saying that they'll do it at the detriment of the profit, but there's a connection to why they're opening this instead of a Chipotle or a McDonald's franchise, where they're given a proven method and trained and said, here's how you open one and here's how you make all the money. They're going down this hard road where nothing is really pre-prepared for them, and they are, basically figuring it out in the dark and saying, yeah, they want to own a quilt store. They want to sell quilt fabric.
It's really remarkable. It's a huge challenge. Yeah. It's amazing. And how much merchandise they have to carry is remarkable. It's a big investment to have a quilt shop.
Absolutely. And, again, they're doing it with what? They're doing it with savings. They're doing it with, pensions, retirement. That's why a lot of quilt store owners, open their stores and they're already, they're not my age. You know, they're not in their 30s or 40s. They're in their 60s. They're in their 50s. And it is quite remarkable. It's also something, you know, I saw quite a bit of in comics. And it's just now that you're starting to see the younger store owner, which is that shift in the market that I was talking about. We're starting to see younger people coming in, which is starting to lower the age, the average age, which is good. And it's going to bring a revitalization, but it's also going to bring changes to an industry that is very rigid in how it does things. And so that's where I think some of the growing pains are going to come from.
Rigid in what way?
You know, again, you're talking about fabric companies that sell fabric in one particular way. They take pre-orders, they print to order, maybe a little extra, they ship it. They then take orders for the next collection. There's really no area there to account for when a particular line is more popular than another. You know, it's sort of like, well, we'll reprint that maybe in the fall. You know, it's like, no. We have demand for it now, but we can't get it.
That's really interesting.
And, you know, it's sort of like this, again, it's part of the printing processes that have been around for ages. It's part of their ordering processes. I think distribution, at least my experiences with distribution companies for, let's say, for someone like me to get my patterns and my products out into the world, I find those methods to be very antiquated. They need a lot of new infrastructure there that perhaps they're not able to do, or they're just unwilling to do. And so clothes stores are still ordering the same way they were 5 years ago, when everything about the internet and how we live day to day with phones in our pockets and all that is different from 5 years ago. And so those are the growing pains that the industry is starting to experience. And I think that, again, this is going to come from, you know, a shift in demographic, a shift in education. You know, I think, you know, one of the things that I did in comic books was teach comic book stores how to, you know, upgrade their infrastructure, and specifically by putting in point of sale and inventory tracking and things like that. So, I mean, you can't know how you're running your business until you can actually track how well you're doing. And that was never something that the comic book industry did. Very few retailers tracked their inventory before the distributor that I worked for came up with a point of sale program that allowed them to track their inventory, be more successful, drop lines that weren't selling well, because, you know, they perhaps love Superman comics, but perhaps Superman comics don't sell well in their area, but they love it, so they keep buying it, you know? And that's true of a lot of things in this industry. I think that, you know, not just putting in the point of sale, but knowing how to understand the reports that come out of it. Those are skills that if you just went into this business because you loved it, maybe aren't the skills that are highest on your list. And if you don't have someone in your organization or in your store structure that can look at those reports and report them to you, you know, you just keep buying the stuff because it's awesome, thinking that it sells when you have like a whole back room of it. I think that stores have a very, they have the hardest road because they don't have the time. You know, you're running a store, it's almost a 24/7 job, you know, you barely have time to watch television for yourself, much less watch training video on how to use their point of sale system.
That's really interesting.
So I get it.
And do you find that there are resources out there? Or are they all really just doing this all on their own? Is there someone, like what you said, where you went from to, you know, helped comic book stores sort of modernize? Is there a resource out there for people to do this? Or again, is it just sort of hoping to stumble onto someone like you that just could help them, you know, think about it differently? Or sort of, how do they, if someone's listening to this, which no one's listening yet, but if someone ever does listen to this, and they're a store owner and they go like, yeah, that's me. Where do they turn in terms of like trying to think through things?
Well, so there's a lot of different resources that are happening right now. There is an organization called the Fab Shop Network, which does have sort of the idea it's like a store in a box. And what that is it's like training manuals and employee handbooks and sort of like what to do if you need to run a sale, best methods for counting your inventory. They have all those resources as part of being a member of the Fab Shop Network, and that's for fabric stores, Fab Shop. And so there's resources there. There's also training that does happen at Quilt Market, and I have been one of those speakers, and I am going to be one of the speakers at the Spring 2018 Market. And those, and that is what I think that Quilt Market can offer, not just stores as a reason to attend, right? Because now if they're getting their information about the new lines of fabric via email, they don't need to come to market to actually physically touch it or look at it. If it's a product line that they know they can sell, then that cuts out a trip for them. So you have to give a store owner another reason to come. And that is, it's got to be education. Yeah. And QuiltThink is very good at education. And I think that if they were to provide more education for stores and more education for independents as well, for designers, yeah, and, you know, other people trying to break into the industry, then we all wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel every time. Now, online, in Facebook, there are many groups of store owners and quilt pattern designers and fabric designers, and there's a group there for everybody. And they have been sharing these tips and tricks with each other. And that is a valuable resource, is when you have a store owner who is willing to share and help other store owners. In the comic book industry, they formed their own professional network. So they created their own organization to be part of that provided some of that. And then they had an annual meeting where, you know, publishers and manufacturers came together and retailers could really express like their concerns about the industry directly. I know that that's what Quilt Market serves, but their professional network gave the retailer more weight in the room, to so to speak. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like they were able to say, "This is our meeting, so you're going to play by our agenda." And I think that, you know, retailers, you know, can form an organization and say to the fabric manufacturers, we really don't like it when you do XYZ. They can say to the distributors, like, why are these products always out of stock when the person, I can order it direct and she has it in stock? It's that kind of frustration.
Yeah.
So I think that those are the things that can be solved when the retailer's voice is the one that's the heaviest. Mm-hmm. But I think when you go to Quilt Market and you look around and you see these giant industry booths.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you sort of know who holds the weight.
Right. It's pretty
and really
interesting.
Our industry is built on the store owners. You know, they're the ones moving the product.
Yeah, I think it would be a really interesting study to look at sort of that, almost like a bird's eye view of both the market and the festivals, because I think it would give you like, you know, almost a
you know, a percentage of how this whole thing operates by the square footage that each group has, I think it'd be really fascinating because it physicalizes an industry in a way that's remarkable. I'm sure every mm-hmm. convention does, but it really does it in a really dramatic way.
Yeah, and you know, we are so lucky to work in such a niche market. I mean, we're like a sub niche of a sub niche when we really think about it, mm-hmm. right? So there's like overall a leisure category, right? We're not a necessity. You don't need us to survive. You don't need us to, you know, we're not food, we're not shelter, we're not a utility, right? We're a leisure category. And then we're in the arts and crafts of the leisure category. And then we're in the sewing subset of the of the arts and crafts leisure category. And then we're like even further down in quilting. So we're really niche. You know, when you look at, and people I'm sure drive by quilt stores just like I drive by other types of stores and say, wow, there's a store for that. And we're so lucky
right.
to be in that industry and make our living that way. And I think it's really cool. And I know if I couldn't make money at it, I wouldn't do it. That's how I look at it, right? If all of a sudden, you know, the everything dried up and I couldn't make money in quilting anymore, well, then I would go do something else. So yeah.
Well, that's
it. I think it's really neat.
Yeah, I think that, so we've gotten to our first question and I still have more parts of our first question, so it's ridiculous. but I think this is so great. I'm going to be like, can we just like...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Continue to chat. So let's keep going. So I see a couple other layers of this industry. First, I see that what you said,
okay.
the distinction between those that are in the industry for as a livelihood and as a hobby. And then that in between where you're
yes.
kind of a hobbyist, but you kind of want to make a little bit of money. So there's kind of this, that layer is really interesting to me. That relationship of, you know, you have to appeal to people like me to buy stuff so that you can continue to do what you want to do. So there's an interesting element to it, even though it's got the history stuff and the museums and all that. But there's that aspect to it. And there seems to be like a tension in that because... Like everything else, I do a lot on fan fiction and fan art in my other life. And so, you know, you see that
mm-hmm.
it used to be publishers and then consumers. But now the consumers want to also be creating things that are for sale. And so this causes the publishers
mm-hmm.
or the manufacturers to kind of freak out. So it seems like we got a little bit of that in quilting as well, this kind of user-generated creations that are sometimes infringing and sometimes not with people who didn't expect to have competition from their consumers. Do you see that as part of the industry at this point?
Yeah, and I think that, again, you know, for people like me who make our living and we're very professional about it, we've got a business tax ID, we've registered with the state and, you know, all this, but it is no longer a hobby. Like, it is our main income. we find it really frustrating in this industry to compete against someone who's sort of dabbling, getting their feet under them. I'm certain that it's the exact same way that we got started, but what they're doing is offering, you know, patterns for free, mm-hmm. or for, you know, or they're giving away content when we need to monetize it. And what it's created is a consumer who is rabidly out there for free content. And they look at our paid content and say, oh, that's too expensive.
Right.
And, you know, that, and sometimes the content's really similar, like maybe too similar, perhaps. You know, I think that generally the idea of copyright and ownership of IP is not in the average hobbyist's mindset, and therefore they think it's perfectly okay to take your pattern and make 10 copies and give it to all her friends. And, you know, and that education then damages, or that lack of education damages the rest of us. And that's really tough. You know, we who need to make a living at it, we kind of struggle with that. Now, you know, manufacturers, they I'm sure have their own struggles with this too. I am very familiar with it in the comic industry, the fan art.
And people
selling derivative product, and right. And there is going to be, you know, at some point, somebody making a fabric line very similar to a very popular fabric line in hopes of pulling some of that, you know, that popularity away. It's going to happen. It's just not inexpensive for them to do it in our industry. Where you may see it more in our industry is perhaps on a spoon flower.
I'm really wanting to know. It's really interesting.
Right? So uh-huh. I think we're all familiar with, like, you know, the independent designer who's drawn a picture of, like, let's say, a little pug dog, and it has a, like, little funny saying. And they're selling that T-shirt out there themselves on Etsy or whatever. And then they go into one of the big box stores and they see it on a rack. And it's clearly their design and it's clearly their image. And they have now to go try to fight both the manufacturer and the retailer for the theft of their design. I think that we will see stuff like that happening on Spoonflower, where the designers will design something on Spoonflower. They're out there putting their independent creations out there, and it's gotten a lot of attention, or maybe that designer has a big following. And they are already being offered fabric contracts by the manufacturers. But I think that at some point there will be an idea that makes its way out that shouldn't, and there will be a big fallout from that. Has it happened yet? I can't say. Could it happen? That's where I think that for a fabric designer, that's where the danger is for them.
It's really, really interesting. Okay, so we're still mapping. So there's that aspect. Then the other mapping I see is kind of generational mapping. So one of the things I did is generational theory for my I have way too many. I like school, so I was in school a really long time. So one of the things, I'm still in school, right? So I just teach it and get paid as opposed to on the other side. So I study generational theory, and what I see here is the tradition. There's a lot of younger people doing this stuff, and I'm really interested in that space, which is kind of defining
what's cool and what isn't. I think about the Quilty Box and other things of like, you know, you get what's cool and like who is cool and like all of that seems kind of, I just got handed a Christmas cookie. Just got handed a cookie. It's awesome. But, you know, I'm trying to really understand where that group fits in. They're online. They're doing podcasts. They're putting out product. They are very, very active the way you are, very active in social media. And I'm wondering how this wave of new quilters, like the young quilters, although young is very relative, but sort of maybe not young quilters, probably new media quilters. Let's call them that, right? So that they're using the media that's there to really brand themselves and it's kind of remarkable in that way. So I'm really curious about that because it seems like they are interacting with large scale manufacturers sometimes not. But it's a different breed than just the traditional quilting shops and things like that. Would you agree about that? And sort of talk a little bit about that crowd.
So I think you're seeing the same thing the industry is seeing. And I think that, you know, everyone's sort of like looking at the new rock star, right? And when quilting was, you know, when I started quilting in 1997, you know, there were quilting rock stars. They were out there, but they had books. They had, right. You know.
So who were the quilting rock stars? Who were the quilting rock stars when you started? Give me an example. Are they still around
who
today?
Who were they? Oh, gosh. They were the Paula Nadelsterns. They were, you know, Pepper Corey. They were Ellie Sienkiewicz. Who, you know, I would be shocked if any modern quilter who's only quilted for 5 years even knows who she is. Mm-hmm. You know, they were people who published a book on a particular style of quilting that was how you found out about new styles of quilting. It was a book came out. And, you know, those people went on the circuit. They would appear at my quilt guild. My quilt guild would hire them to come in and talk about their style, and that's how I would be exposed to them. Now, there's the internet, there's Instagram, there's, you know, all these different ways for the word to get out. And are those quilting rock stars still out there? Absolutely. Pepper Corey's still out there. Paula Nadelstern's still out there. They're still teaching. They're still making cool fabrics. They're still writing books. They're still writing patterns. But are they Tula Pink? No. Right. And Tula Pink has a following that no one can match right now. Like, her fabric sells out before it even hits the shelves. And it's, you know, there's an amazing branding that's happening there. There's an amazing sort of whole consumer that's been generated there. There's an aftermarket now for her fabric, for her older out-of-print lines. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah,
and I don't think that's something that could happen. That could not happen in 1997.
It's these new business models. So, it's so interesting, isn't it?
It is. And I do think that if you want to be part of it, then you have to go with it, right?
Yeah.
And you have to embrace your inner rock star. And I feel like sometimes as women and as, you know, we're not here for business. We're here to take our hobby and make it our job. And if we make a little money or make a little side money, that's great. I don't think we're comfortable. I say this in the general we, because I certainly feel comfortable talking about myself. But most women don't feel comfortable talking about themselves or promoting themselves. And I think there's a thing, too, about women who say, oh, all she does is talk about herself. And
that sounds about right.
And so it puts up a barrier, right? It puts up a barrier where it's like, no, no, this is promotion for my business.
Yeah.
My business is me.
Yeah.
And I think that they, you know, when they can't separate you, the person, from you, the business, and they've shut you out, then that just creates, that makes your business even harder.
Yeah.
The thing about coming in as a brand from the get-go creates this sort of, creates this sort of buzz that is really hard to bottle. If you don't have it, and you can try, but the most part of branding like that comes from authenticity. And if you are not authentic and you are, you know, not the same person that you get in person that you get online, then the consumer decides that there's that disconnect and they shut down.
That's really interesting.
So, yeah, I think that the consumer is different, the market is different, how we consume the content is different. So branding has become a very, very important part of being in this industry. And I think that people haven't really caught up to it yet.
Yeah, I'll be really interested to see if that average age moves significantly because of who is the dominant, like if you go online, sort of more and more dominant, it's like kind of cool 20s, 30s, 40-year-olds. And it'll be really interesting to see if that market, if they take over that market. They're making it cool and okay to be doing the, I mean, and sometimes it's not just quilting, it's crafting, it's all kinds of other stuff.
Sure.
There's a power out there that is kind of remarkable. And it'll be really interesting to see what you and all of the others do with this newfound
power.
Well,
I think a lot of it comes down to, do you have something that people want?
Yeah.
You know, you can have the coolest brand in the world. You can have the most curated Instagram. It could be perfection by most people's standards. But what are you selling?
Yeah.
And if you don't have a compelling sell, then, I mean, you know what Tulip Kink is selling you. You know what, Violet Craft is selling you. You know what Libs Elliott is all about. They're very, very stylized. Elizabeth Hartman, same thing. You know exactly what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And people want to buy that.
Yeah.
I could have, like, the coolest, hippest, Instagram in the world, but if I'm not selling what people want to buy, why are you watching? You know, what are you looking for? You can consume that content, but it's not going to make you any money.
Yeah.
And
that's what's so interesting about it, too, right? So that you have to be your own thing, but appeal to people enough that they're going to buy what you're doing. It's really complicated in some way, you know?
Yeah, I think sometimes we make it more complicated than it needs to be. And I think everyone's out to try to copy because, well, that's clearly working for her, so I should right. just do what she's doing. And that doesn't always work. I think that could have worked 10 years ago. But now there's such a distinct like branding and style that just can't be copied, that it is more authentic for you to be yourself. And gain your following that way.
Yeah, it's really, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because when you think about all of the industry, I want that, right? The Tulip Pink crowd is a great example, right? There are other people doing designs that have, the similar colors or weird little animals or whatever, but that's not what it's about for the crowd that loves Tulip Pink. It's the brand, right? It's what they expect.
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing this and
yeah.
like that she's a huge example, but Elizabeth Hartman's another one, right? So it'll be interesting to see if there's brand loyalty when there's copycats. Like, if you see, because, at the show, there was another
right.
booth that had Elizabeth Hartman-like designs. And she doesn't, Elizabeth Hartman doesn't have a lock on what she does, right? There's a lot of parts that aren't protectable. But does the person,
Do they say, I'm not going to that one because I support Elizabeth Hartman, right? Is there a moral element to it of...
Right.
And I think there is...
That is what we're going to find out.
Yeah.
I mean, that is what we're going to find out.
Yeah. It's so interesting. And then you have to be aware that Elizabeth Hartman exists and that this is a copycat. So that's an interesting thing of, like, how much does the public need to know these brands so that they understand and make choices. So... I don't know. It's really fascinating to see this industry. Okay, one more. We're way out of time. But one more. There's one more layer that I think is there that I think is really interesting. And then, Cheryl, I don't know if you'd be willing, but I would love to have more conversations with you because I really, really like chatting with you about this stuff.
Yeah, of course.
So I think there's one more layer, which is the big manufacturer, the sort of well-known one, and the sort of startup kind of quilt entrepreneur just getting started, that layer's in there as well, and they all coexist at the quilt market, which is so interesting too. So I'm curious about what your thoughts are about, you know, the role of the big manufacturers, you know, the and then these little ones that are like, I made a thing for thimbles, or I made a thing for rulers, or, you know, these teeny tiny companies that have, like, usually like one or two products that are trying to sort of break in. So it's got this kind of can-do American inventor spirit, which is quite lovely to see. But they all exist in the same room, which is so fascinating, too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, you start to see some of the manufacturers say, oh, you have really good ideas. Would you design now for us?
Yeah.
And I do see that happening. Like at Clover, for example, right? So Clover, who has made notions and tools for ages now, has people coming in as a designer and designing lines of products. Like Nancy Zeman has a line of children or learning to sew friendly you know, packaging. And it's not just packaging, but they've been retooled. These are things that are new, newly manufactured. And I think that is a really interesting model for manufacturers that I see that's happening. There are other manufacturers doing this as well, where they're saying, you are a well-known quilt celebrity, let's say, and if you are a quilt celebrity, then, you know, come bring some of your brand awareness to us.
Right.
And we'll give you the ability to design rulers and templates and thread and all these cool things in exchange for us to use your likeness and so on. And so I think that is one area that manufacturing is starting to pull from the independent designer. But there's an incredible amount of entrepreneurial spirit in the quilt industry. And the amount of, like, tools that even I have developed, right? I can count myself as one of these people.
That's right.
And, you know, I had a need. I could not find it in a tool that existed. And so I made one.
Yeah.
And I made it for myself and realized, oh, other people would probably buy this. And they do.
That's
and
really
so I think that, you know, again, it's the we're talking about a niche within a niche within a niche again.
Right.
You know, my heirloom sewing tools are very specifically, you know, heirloom sewing is another subset of general sewing and general quilting. So I think that you're never going to get that mainstream market unless you did hit a manufacturer who made it bigger for you.
Yeah.
So are there opportunities? Yeah, absolutely. And yes, it gives me an opportunity to go around and teach my message and sell more product. And, you know, and I think that that's how that happens. And that's how I make my living. It is a great thing to be able to see, like, the independent, you know, designer next to, you know, the big manufacturer.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. All right, so there's one more layer, and then I think we can, we'll stop for the day because I know we've already gone an hour. But I think there is one more layer, and that's the teaching exhibit. So I think, I don't know if they go hand in hand, but there's this, you know, the teaching circuit, which we can talk about another time, and then also the exhibit contest exhibition kind of that, like those two layers are also part of this industry, which is really, and the guilds. So like you've got that part of it in here as well, which is like amazing. So and you participate in those as well. So, you know, how much of your brand and reputation rely on, you know, getting to the guilds and teaching at places like, you know, the quilt market and quilt festival? And then how much is it important to be having your stuff in shows? Like, is that as part of your brand? Do you have to have those parts of, I mean, not everybody has both of those parts, but I'm curious what your thoughts are about that aspect of the industry.
Well, I mean, my whole, you know, how I started was in competition quilting. And I quickly realized I wasn't very good at it. I would get my quilts into the show. They may win a ribbon, but they're never going to win. I say never, but it will take me a while, many years from now, maybe, I would win like a best of show or a $10,000 cash prize. That kind of competition level, there are people in that hunt. There are people who make their living Amazing. That way, that they make quilts to potentially win cash prizes. And for the most part, they're professional because they've earned money at it. That's the technical term of professional versus amateur in that world. Have you earned money from it? Yes, you have. Well, you're now a professional. You're no longer amateur. And in that respect, there's only a few people who would qualify in that realm, right? Because they put out a competition piece and it is made to go out and win money. And I can think of a few different quilters who are like that, and that's what they do. Now, what I did was I started off that way, put my quilts out there, and realized people wanted to know how I made that. And so then quickly pivoted towards teaching it, teaching the method, teaching, you know, that particular style or whatever, and then made my living that way. Now, I still make about one competition piece per year. It's never going to be it's never going to be a best in show, but it gives me the opportunity to say, would you like to see my work? It's going to be traveling and here's all the places it will be. And so then for those people who are just in general fans of my work, they can go see, my quilt somewhere in a quilt show near them. It has helped me get, bookings. It has helped me, you know, get quilt guilds. I do find that I still, again, in the world of quilting, because I'm not somebody who has like 10 books or any books. So whatever, if anyone wants to give me a book contract, I'm totally open to that.
Totally.
But there is some slight recognition where if you're online and you're an online quilter and you're very connected with, you know, Facebook and Instagram and all that, you know me.
Yeah.
If you're not, which a lot of guild members aren't, they have no clue who I am. And when I show up, they're like, oh, she's much younger than we thought she would be. And I end up having this, and I have this sort of like, let me tell you when I started quilting in 1997. And yes, that was, you know, back when I was a small child. And they laugh, even though I wasn't a small child. They laugh because clearly I couldn't have been quilting since 1997.
Right.
I must only be 20 years old in their eyes. And I get that a lot.
Yeah.
And I do find that sometimes it affects my bookings for classes because I don't have like that top level name recognition.
Interesting.
And sometimes I do. I think a lot of it does come down to the project. So if the guild picks the good project, then I steal the class. If the guild picks one of my little weirder projects, then my classes don't fill up as much.
Yeah.
And I leave it to them to decide. Like, if they want to pick the weird stuff, great. If they want to pick the mainstream stuff, fine. I'm there to pitch all of it. And so, you know, it's really, does it affect my, you know, bookings and attendance? Yeah, I think it does.
That's really interesting.
So if you're very online and very connected, then you know who I am, and it's great. If you are somebody who's like, oh, I don't use Facebook.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, well, then no wonder you don't know who I am.
Right, because you need a book. Because you need a book. It's all about the, for that crowd, it's still about probably very traditional mediums of books and things like that.
Yeah.
I'd imagine.
Yeah. And I think that's where demographic comes in. That's where, you know, a lot of factors come in where people are just like, oh, I'm just not good on the internet. So I only go and look and see my grandkids on the Facebook every once in a while.
Right.
Where other people are like, you know, I have a group of what I call super users.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, I can't put a post up that they don't like within like 5 minutes.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of that in the popularity of these big brands, these bigger names.
Yeah.
And they'll get booked.
Right.
You know, they get booked more than I do.
Well, I've got a total idea for you. So I think you probably already do this, but I think what you probably already do this because I am so like don't have like new ideas. But I think that for the people that don't know you, putting out like a book or a thing where it's all about like cool quilts for your grandkids would be awesome. The idea that like I know you want to make something for your grandkid. How about something that, you know, lights up or has a cool robot or whatever? I would imagine that you'd the grandma crowd would be going crazy for your stuff because they want to make stuff for their grandkids, but, you know, the grandkids don't really care. So,
well, and I think that it is a matter of, you know, like, oh, well, I like them, but their stuff is not to my taste.
Right.
And I get that. You know, I'm the one who has a skull for a logo. So, you know, when you have a skull for a logo, you're immediately going to turn off a certain part of the market.
Yeah.
But in my mind, that person was never my customer.
No.
Right? If you're turned off by the idea of a skull on my product line, then you're not my customer.
Right, right.
And so I don't spend time worrying about people who are not my demographic.
Yeah.
I did already move my product line around to be more mainstream, about as mainstream as it can be. But in the end, you know, I know that people still follow me for me. And so I have to embrace the things that make me. And if my thing is to make heirloom sewing cool and a little more rock and roll, you know, you could go Martha Pullen's way and, you know, you could be very heirloom traditional, or you could be a little more rock and roll heirloom and do things my way. And that to me is that's the difference.
Yeah. Well, I think your stuff is awesome.
Yeah,
I think, and I think that's true of every quilt. I mean, that's the branding, right? You're not everything to everyone. That's the whole point of branding, is that, you know, you appeal to the people that want, and I mean, that's the essence of branding, right? So that someone who wants, you know, granola versus Lucky Charms knows which brand to get, right? They know what product to get. So.
Mm-hmm.
So,
exactly.
Yeah.
And there's not always the same customer. Is there the occasional crossover? Sure there is.
Right.
But for the most part, I'm not going to spend my energy going after a Martha Pullen customer.
Yeah.
Because they're going to take one look at me and go, she's a little too out there for me. and I get that. Yeah. You know, pink hair and a skull t-shirt probably isn't going to be your thing. And so I think that, you know, I do see that the industry is going to have to open its mind a little bit more. You know, we were talking about that a little bit.
Yeah.
I do think that there's a lot of still traditional values in quilting that we're pushing the boundaries on. That's a tough, that's going to be a tough nut to crack.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it is a hobby that automatically skews generationally older.
Yeah.
And it's also a very affluent hobby.
Yeah.
Quilting is very expensive.
Yeah.
And so unlike knitting where you can go get a $1 ball of yarn and a really, you know, $2 pair of sticks, you know, it really isn't that accessible. We're still not cutting up clothing to make quilts.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not for necessity at this point. I do think they make very good post-apocalyptic life skills.
totally.
I think that, you know, when we're the only ones who are keeping ourselves warm and clothed, then people, you know where know to keep us alive. That part.
Exactly. It's so true. It's so true. That's so funny.
But I think that, I do think that, you know, these are the types of things that people lament. Like, oh, grandma was really good at quilting. I wish I learned how to sew from her. And, you know, there's so many of those crafts out there, you know, like chair caning and vegetable canning and rug hooking. And it still exists, but in these very, very small markets, in these very small places, and very few people who are out there saying, I'm going to teach the next generation how to cane a chair.
Yeah.
That just doesn't... That's just not a thing. It's certainly not a thing around here in Chicago.
No.
And so you really have to, you know, learn those things from people who are willing to teach it. And the great thing about quilting is there's so many people willing to teach it. And and it is a mainstream enough hobby that it has stores and a culture dedicated to it. So I think we're, again, when I said we were lucky, we are very lucky to be in this day and age.
Yeah. Well, Shel, this has been so awesome. And we got to the first question, so it's really good. We did an hour on the first question.
Well, I guess there has to be a part three.
I think that would be awesome. Well, I have to tell you, I really, really adore chatting with you. I always feel like I learned so much, and it's really fun. So yeah, let's do a part three. I think that's great. All right, I'm going to end the recording. Anything else that we want to say before we end? No?
No.
Okay, good. Okay, cool. Okay, I'm going to stop all the mini recordings of this, and then hold on just a second. So this is Elizabeth Townsend-Gard. You've been listening to Just Want a Quilt, a research podcast coming out of Tulane University Law School. We want to hear from you. Join our army, our quilting army. Go to our Facebook page. Suggest people to be interviewed. Suggest yourself to be interviewed. We are excited to hear from you. But most importantly, I hope you get a chance to quilt today.